You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, and it's my honor today to have two of our nation's most productive and innovative and committed members of the House Armed Services Committee to talk about defense priorities. We have Congressman Rick Larson and Congressman Ed Bacon from Nebraska, respectively, the second districts of Washington and Nebraska. So that part I have right. They're both from the respective state's second districts. And I should have said about Congressman Bacon that he's also a freshman member, but also a retired brigadier general in the Air Force, who's had an extensive career with many deployments and in specializations such as reconnaissance and electronic warfare, so has a lot of expertise. Congressman Larson has been on the Armed Services Committee for a number of years and now has been in Congress for a decade and a half or so, and also sits on the Transportation Committee, Congressman Bacon also on the Small Business Committee. So we have a lot of breadth in what we're going to talk about today. We're going to focus in on the defense budget, defense priorities, but also link this to broader discussions in the Congress today about where we stand in the budget process and in the nation's overall strategic priorities. So if you wouldn't mind, and I want to thank SICE as well for hosting us, but please join me in welcoming the congressman here to Massachusetts.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So I think we've got a couple of opening comments from both Congressman Don Bacon and Congressman Rick Larson. So I'll give them each the floor just to frame a couple of their thoughts as they look at the defense landscape today. As you know, we're already 11 days into a new fiscal year, but we don't yet have a new budget. We have a continuing resolution. Congress is fated. It's perhaps to be in town for a number of additional weeks, even though this is the time of year people are supposed to be looking elsewhere, perhaps. So there's a lot of ongoing and undone and unfinished business, and I think I'm just going to ask each of them to frame how they see things today before we launch into our topic-by-topic discussion. So I guess Congressman Larson, as the senior member here, will give the floor to you first. Senior. And thanks again for being here.
I've been here long enough to be a senior member, I guess. 17 years in the House of Representatives now, and 17 years on the Armed Services Committee. And first, let me thank Brookings and SICE for hosting us this morning, and for those folks listening at home and watching at home as well. I guess if I wanted to frame this, I've got longer comments, but we're going to do some Q&A where some of this detail will come out. But if you wanted to frame this debate in the Armed Services Committee and the House of Representatives, I think you look think about a triangle, and it has obviously three points on it. One point would be procurement, that is our willingness and our ability to purchase the capabilities that our U.S. military needs to ensure that we are never in an actual fair fight, that we always have the advantage. So procurement's on one point. Operations on another point, that, of course, being the idea that we are deployed, our military is deployed around the world. We're operating in a variety of places in the world, and I think we'll go through that list as we move forward this morning. And that comes with a cost to it as well and an investment. And then the third point would be readiness. That is our ability, our willingness to ensure that the folks we do send, that we do deploy, are ready, that they've been trained, that they have the backup, that they, as well, that they have the things that they need. That's on the procurement side. So these three points on the triangle, procurement, readiness, and operations, sort of are always in attention, pushing and pulling on each other when we have this budget debate in Congress. When it comes to the defense budget. But as we've heard from our military leaders, that tension is becoming more and more under duress as sequestration and budget caps continue. And that sort of frames the budget environment, if you will, from an objective sense, pulling back from who's a Democrat or who's a Republican. But from an objective sense, the frames of debate that we have in the House Armed Services Committee, in our marathon markups that we do in May, on the floor of the House, as well as frames of debate between the House and the Senate, which tend to take different approaches to this triangle of tension, I guess. I just coined that. I'm going to trademark that. You can't use it. Thank you.
I like it. Well, it's going to frame a lot of what we come back to. I'm definitely going to use that myself. Maybe even a title for a book someday. Anyway, I'll give you full credit. Congressman Bacon, thank you for being here as well, and love to hear your overall thoughts on threats facing the country as well as the defense budget context. Well,
thank you. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate the invite. It's great to be with you this morning. And I don't fault you for not knowing my first name. I did 30 years in the Air Force. No one knew my real name because we have a call sign. I was Bacon Bits or Bits Bacon. So people try to find me on the computer. They never could because it was Don Bacon. But it's great to be here. But what I really wanted to open up with was saying when I came in 1985 and in the 90s, we flew as an Air Force. I was an electronic warfare officer. Flew 2 to 1 hours over what the Russians or Chinese air crews were flying. We had undoubtedly the strongest, most lethal Air Force military joint force in the world. I would still say we are the preeminent military, but it's been eroded. Today, the crews that are flying one-third of the hours that I used to fly. And I just want you to think about what that has an impact on training and readiness and operations. When you folks are flying one-third of the hours, and folks are getting out because it's not rewarding to fly that with just the minimal hours. And it's so, and it's just one indication. If you hear what the chiefs are telling Congressman Larson and myself when they come in, out of 57 combat brigades, only 3 can deploy tonight or be ready to fight tonight. Only half the Navy aircraft are able to fly on any given day. And you could just take that example after example. We're struggling. Our readiness is a huge issue on one of those 3 parts of that tension of the triangle there. So and it's been impacted significantly by the budget caps. I think the budget caps were a punch to the face of our military. But the 31 continuing resolutions has been a kick in the gut as well. And you put those 2 together, the military's hurting. So that's the first part I wanted to make. The second part is I think if you look around the world, and when I came in, it was the Soviet Union was their big focus. And frankly, it was a shock to me in 89 when, boom, it collapsed. But as we look now, we're back into this big power tensions again with Russia, China. And I think they're looking at changing the world international order that we have helped build since World War II that's focused on individual liberty, democracy, free enterprise, free and fair trade, if you will, in there, but that's not their vision. And then we have North Korea and Iran. So we have some, and then we have ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We have significant threats out there that we're having to deal with a military that is much weaker today than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And that concerns me. But what I'd really like to close on for just opening comments is I think our gravest threat is our partisan divide. I think if you look at Republicans and Democrats, most, I'm not saying all, we have not unanimity on both sides in this, but I think consensus-wise, know that we need to do more for the military, that we needed to increase spending. But because of the partisan rancor and the vitriol, we have not been able to plus up military spending in recent years, though we know we've needed it. And basically, it's been held sort of hostage for the debate over domestic spending. And do we spend more, cut more? And that's impacted what we've done on the military side. And I think that in years past, we've had partisan divides too, but we've always known defense is job number one for the federal government. And we've been able to overcome that, at least agree on that. I mean, I could go look at examples from Eisenhower and Kennedy and Nixon. I mean, partisan divides, but we knew that the military defending our nation was one of the first things that we should do in the federal government and come together. So it is my hope that we're always going to have debates and partisan rancor, but national security shouldn't be subjected to it and held hostage to it. So thank you.
Thank you, Congressman. And I want to come back later to this issue of readiness and how things got so bad and why they're so bad, because on its face, the budget doesn't look that small, but we know we're asking a lot out of the military.
About $550 billion.
Well, yeah, and so, which is, you know, if you add in the contingency budget, we're actually above the Cold War average in real terms. Mm-hmm. And So that frames the whole discussion. So I'll come back to this issue of the readiness crisis and the triangle of tension in a minute. But I wanted to ask you both to try to handicap for us where you think the budget debate will likely wind up. And this is something that I'm trying to figure out. I don't claim to have any real clairvoyance on this. We know that President Trump requested a modest increase in the military budget that would have been $54 billion above the sequestration level and about maybe half that much above what Obama's budget implied. And now we know that Chairman Thornberry and McCain and with the committees in general have been promoting a budget about $60 billion, or excuse me, $40 billion or so higher than mm-hmm. Trump.
Right.
But neither of these is actually allowable under the Budget Control Act, unless mm-hmm. you do it all through contingency operations funding and sort of abuse that account for purposes it wasn't intended for, even more than we are today. So I guess my question is a two-part question. If Trump is sort of in the mid-600s with his budget, once you add in all the defense budget, you know, the Department of Energy nuclear weapons, Department of Defense-based budget, overseas contingency operations. If you add all those together, President Trump's proposed a little bit over 650, mm-hmm. and the HASC and the SASC have proposed something around $700 billion each.
Yeah, 698 or, yep, you're right.
So where are we going to end up, and how do you handicap the odds? Maybe mm-hmm. since you're in the majority on this one, Congressman Bacon, I'll start with you.
I think when you look at the Senate, and you have to have a bipartisan approach, because when you start looking at the filibuster and getting the group going, that's where the center of gravity is going to be at in this discussion. I like where the House and the Armed Services Committee came out. We were sitting around 640 plus the contingency funding, which does take us around 700. I think that paid for most of the unfunded requirements that the services gave us. So I'm an advocate for that spending level and then trying to hold it at that level with inflation. But the real debate, as I mentioned earlier in the opening comments, will be about what do we do in the domestic spending area, or as well as in entitlement spending. And I would prefer taking the national security side and just say, let's do the right thing there, and let's have these debates over here. But I think that's where the debate will be at in the Senate primarily, and it's going to take compromise. I think if one side or the other side think they're going to get everything they want on the domestic and entitlement side, we're going to end up where we're at right now, which is a gridlock. So I think that we're going to have to reach across the aisle and get this done.
Love to get your thoughts.
Yeah,
as well.
I think this is where Don and I will differ, mm-hmm. And probably pretty strongly in some respects. Only that as members of the Armed Services Committee, from a committee perspective, we have a responsibility to the committee and the work that we do. As members of Congress, we've got a broader responsibility to the budget and to the function of government and the debate about the function of government. I say that as a premise to say that I don't believe we should separate the domestic budget debate from the non-domestic or the defense budget debate, because we have to pass an entire budget, not a budget. Sort of picking one part of the budget out and setting it aside and say it's special versus these other things that are not special undermines other aspects of our national economic security, the investments that we make in transportation, the investments we make in higher education, and so on. So this idea that we can somehow separate parts of the budget in this debate and say that we're going to first deal with one and not deal with the other in the context of the first seems to me a bit irresponsible. And we've had this debate in the past. We continue to have this debate, and what we have settled on is that if we blow caps on one side, we're going to blow caps on the other side. If we blow caps on non-domestic or defense, we're going to blow the caps on domestic. That everybody's in the pool together, and that's where I am. That's where I think where the Democrats are going to be. In the House, and the Democrats will be in the Senate as we move forward on this debate. And I think we ought to do that, because I don't think we can. If we separate we're not actually talking about separating the national security budget. We're talking about separating the defense budget. The State Department in this debate would be in the not national security budget, and would have to eat its 31% proposed cut that the administration has proposed, which Secretary Mattis, among others, has said he's okay doing that so long as you give him more ammunition. That is, if you cut the State Department budget that much, you're going to have to do a lot more in military on the defense side in order to make up for the lack of diplomacy that the U.S. would be involved in. So I just, I'm trying to make the case that, the other case, the bookend of this argument, and which I do stand for as well, that you can't separate the defense budget from the domestic budget. And as far as a line, if you will, that's going to be part of this debate in Congress as we move forward, that is one of those lines that will.
So given your views, which are both extremely eloquent and well stated, and yet also sound familiar because we've sort of been in this philosophical debate for a long time. What's going to happen? How's it going to end? And I realize nobody has a crystal ball, but if we could just sort of war game out the scenarios a little bit, and I don't want to ask you to give away, you know, tactics within your caucus or anything, but to the extent that you can roughly weight the odds of the caps being busted on both sides, for example, and that being acceptable to the Republican caucus in both houses of Congress. Congressman Bacon, back to you. Do you think that there is the potential for a compromise where the caps go up on both sides, or do you think that it's more likely that, you know, the caps stay where they are and ultimately we don't get the budget increase on the defense side that you want?
Well, I think we'll get to the point where the caps will be taken off, at least for defense, because I think we can't continue having a military policy that has us at 550 and trying to do things in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, have a deterrence force for North Korea, be a deterrence force in the South China Sea, be good allies to our Baltic states that are feeling under threat right now in Ukraine, come up with a policy there. It's unaffordable. And so the last 10 years has not worked. When you try to hold the defense hostage to a debate over domestic spending, that's what's happened, we suffer. The military suffer. We had 42 fatalities this summer in training. And if you talk to the service chiefs, what I get from them, it's a combination of being stretched too thin on operational with lack of training. So too few people, too much requirements, not enough training, you put it together. We've added risk to our servicemen and women out there. And I always think lack of, when you have low levels of readiness, our military pays for it in blood. And so we owe it to them to do better. And I would prefer trying to get our military in the healthy spot, but we also have to work towards a fiscal responsible budget. That's why I would oppose a one-for-one equivalent raising in the caps for domestic over military. But I think to say that for every dollar we increase in military, we're going to have to lower a dollar for domestic, though I would prefer having that more as my vision, I don't think it's tenable in this, so we have to reach across the aisle and find a middle ground there. So I think that when it's all said and done, there's going to have to be discussions between the executive branch and Congress, reach across the aisle with primarily Senator Schumer and team in the Senate side, I would presume, to get our military healthy and find what is that middle ground on domestic spending. I hope that's how it's going to end.
Congressman Larson, do you see that as viable, sort of a one-for-two kind of compromise in terms of how high the caps go up on each side, or whatever?
I'm not going to negotiate numbers with anybody today. the one set of numbers you ought to think about, that one could think about in the context of this debate, is the tax cut package has been proposed as well. Again, budgets don't happen in the context of themselves. They happen in the context of everything else that's going on and everything else we spend money on. And tax expenditures are part of that. And so a proposal to cut taxes $1.5 trillion or $5 trillion or whatever the number is, in the context of increasing domestic and defense spending, or only domestic spending, or only defense spending, really makes it, really kind of makes budgeting, turns congressional budgeting into a joke that we are actually telling and are the butt of. So I think that trying to have this debate in Congress on defense spending without the context of the entire budget, including this, an insane tax cut proposal, given what all members want to do on domestic and defense spending, I've watched this movie several times. This is, I think, the third sequel. of the same movie I've watched, and it ends up the same way. We try to finesse our way in Congress structurally through things like budget caps or sequestration without having to make difficult decisions. We're not going to make those difficult decisions by December 8th, which when the CR runs out. We will not have a clean, nice package to hand to everybody. It will be something, but it won't be clean and it won't be nice. I'm really looking forward to that.
If I could piggyback on that, that would be, if we don't do that, if that happens, we'll have a 30-second continuing resolution, and our service chiefs and our combatant commanders have said that the CRs have been terrible for our military. No new starts, you can't give people pay raises, you can't start modernization. The things that you want to do to get our military healthy again are put on hold. Now, I could buy it if it was the first or second time, but it would be the 32nd CR in 10 years. And that's a sign of a dysfunctional government. And we got to make those hard decisions and put on the line. But I would say, again, our military spending is being held hostage to this domestic debate, and our men and women in uniform are paying for it.
I would suggest that I'm not, just to clarify, I'm not suggesting we get a CR on December 8th. I'm suggesting we get an omnibus done. It's just not going to be the nice package that people would want, that I want and Don wants.
Because it's unlikely to have the tax reform as well, or because it's, I mean, if there's ultimately an omnibus.
Because I think at the time we're doing this, it's October 11th, and that's less than 2 months away to December 8th, and there's just not enough time to do this. Well, I think we'll come up with an omnibus package. But I'm not going to predict if budget caps get blown or if we suspend sequestration. That's all going to be part of a bigger deal. There's a lot of pressure on the budget in the military. There's a lot of pressure on the budget on the domestic side as well.
And I
would just note, like, we're holding young kids in Head Start hostage as well. We're holding the budget holds higher ed Pell Grants hostage as well by cutting Pell Grants for kids who are low income trying to pay for school. So it's not just the military being held hostage in this debate.
So I'd like to now turn to the issue of the readiness crisis as it's described and what the service chiefs and others have been saying about this and explore a little bit how seriously you see this problem. And I'll just be upfront that I've been a little bit of a skeptic as to, I know things are tough. I know there's a lot of strain on the force. When the Army says it only has 3 brigades ready, I have to ask myself why. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to pick on the Army a little bit here. And I won't pick on
better
the Air
than the
Force.
Air Force.
And I'm certainly not going to pick on the Marine Corps with John Allen, the recently named president of Brookings.
Yeah. But, congratulations.
Leave the Marines alone. They're all over the place right now.
Exactly. Yeah. But so let's pick on the Army. We can agree on that. And and with apologies to Washington State and our Army friends out there. But
Absolutely. But
I'll say that when the Army complains that it's only got 3 brigades ready out of, 30 in the active force and another almost 30 in the National Guard, I'm confused because the Army's been getting, even with the CRs, the Army's been getting 90% of the requested training budget or more for 4 to 5 years in a row. Sequestration only happened once. That was in 2013. That's getting to be a while back. Continuing resolutions, to my mind, I agree with you. They're very bad because they get in the way of innovation because you can't do new things. But readiness is an ongoing activity. And moreover, the Army, even though it is busy and our soldiers deserve kudos, and I'm sure we all agree on that. Nonetheless, the overall number of brigades deployed or stationed abroad at this point is far fewer than at the peak of Iraq and Afghanistan. We have one in Korea, which rotates through. We have one in the eastern NATO region. We have a couple in the broader Middle East. We have one in Afghanistan. So we have basically about 5 Army brigades deployed out of 57. So why can't the Army get healthy? And what I'm wondering is, do we have to have some of these changes happen from within the services, that they have to look for new innovative ways to be more efficient in how they employ their force, rather than waiting for a $700 billion budget to ride to the rescue and allow a lot more money for everything. So that's my question.
That's a good question. And I think it's a myriad of things that come together. So first of all, when you look at what the proposed budget was under President Obama in 2010, it was about $700 billion for this year, and now we're sitting at $550. So there has been a sizable difference in what we have budgeted out. But I think our modernization has fallen behind. So that's part of the readiness problem in that we have old equipment that you can't count on. So that modernization isn't normally seen as a readiness issue directly, but in the end it becomes one if you have 25-year-old equipment that you can't maintain and get ready. So I think that you have older equipment. You have folks that have been 5, 6, 7, 8 rotations. I know people in the 55th Wing in Omaha that have done 25 rotations to the Middle East. Now, they don't do the full year of rotations. They're 3 and 4 or 5 months, depending on which crew position. But that takes a toll on people. And I think you have a lot of folks who are not mental or health able for health reasons to deploy now, so that puts more weight on a fewer group. So I guess my point would be that the readiness levels is an accumulation of the training budget have been cut. There were some rotations like to the NT National Training Center that they've been reduced in the Air Force. A few years back, we cut deployments to the Red Flag Weapons School. But it's also that we have 25-year-old equipment, at least in the Air Force. I think the Army has roughly the same as well. And then you add in the people have been on multiple rotations, and there's a physical toll. And I think you put that together, that's why we're at today.
Thank you, Congressman.
I think that's part of the story for certain. I think another part of the story is this tension between the procurement and readiness and operations. And the amount of the amount of money that's approved, authorized, and appropriated to the military. Then the choices that are made as the budgets do get squeezed. Choices that get made in the Pentagon after the money's been approved, and where that money goes to. Does it go? If they have to make choices in the Pentagon between training readiness or continuing the purchasing of X number of some type of platform or a weapon system, what is the better choice? What is the better use of that dollar so that it is worth a dollar as opposed to worth 90 cents on the dollar? If you say in the case of platforms or weapon systems, you back off of purchasing, then you lose the economy of scale of that purchase. So that's cumulative over these 32 or 31 CRs. And at some point, as the Secretary Mattis has said, that at some point that just comes and sits down on you. And he didn't say it'll be the 2018 budget, but he's testified to us it'll be the 2019 budget, where this money problem just comes down and sits down on the Pentagon. And by that I mean it just makes it difficult throughout all three of those functions of operations and procurement and readiness to fund things to an adequate level. I'd also say Congress is at fault for a lot of other reasons, too. It's not just the CR issue, but, this is 17 years of being on the committee talking, which is, it's worth whatever you want to put into it. And Don can either back us up or dispute it, which is fine, but it's a matter of Congress saying, no, you won't retire that platform.
Well, I was going to piggyback on that next.
Yeah, and this is especially an Air Force issue, but it's in the Army, it's in the Navy, it's in the Marine Corps. We like, part institutionally, members of Congress like things, if you can kick it and break your foot on it, then we'll fund it, right? If it's like a Navy, if it's steel and gray and floats, then we want to fund it. But if it's an electron, like electronic warfare, which is sort of
that's really sexy stuff.
Real exciting stuff. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it. But the enemy can. But we underfund that because it's not a platform. You can't see it, touch it, and feel it. And members of Congress don't want to not fund platforms, and we don't want to retire platforms either. And so we put provisions in budgets to say, the House puts provisions in and say you can't retire a platform, and then the Senate changes it to say you will study whether or not to retire a platform and report back in 75 years. we are to blame, not just because we don't pass budgets in a timely fashion, but we put provisions in budgets. So we contribute to that as well. It's not just, I don't want to point at a bunch of Pentagon bureaucrats, civilian or military, but Congress is to blame as well for some of this.
If I may just give an example of that. So I think it was 2013 or 14, I was a one-star in the Pentagon. I can't remember the Air Force size of the cut. I want to say $15 billion, but that's going by memory. I may be wrong on that. So the Air Force was given that bogey to figure out how you're going to round that budget out with that kind of a reduction. So the military, or the Air Force, came back and says, well, we really want the Global Hawk, we want the A-10, but if you're going to cut that amount of money, we're better off cutting a whole weapon system versus doing a peanut butter spread, and cut it, because we've been traditionally doing that. So the Air Force came back and said, let's cut the A-10 and the Global Hawk. Congress and said, no, can't do that. So then the Air Force says, well, we'd like to maybe reduce some bases because the optimal base should have 4, 5, 6 flying squadrons in it. But I know some bases out there have 2 flying squadrons. I know one with 1. And so let's reduce some of the bases. And Congress says, no, can't do that either. So we end up cutting training. And that's how you go from 1/3 of the flying hours for air crews today versus what I had as a captain, because that was like the only area that the Air Force could get agreement to make those reductions. I assume the Army had much of that same, you know, process that they had to go through. So you end up, it's easier to cut training, operations, and maintenance and readiness stuff versus, as Congressman Larson here says, the, you know, aircraft and bases. Boy, you try to cut a base, that's the third rail.
I've got one more question to follow up on this mm-hmm. readiness question, and then I want to ask one question about overseas threats and then turn to all of you mm-hmm. for the remaining time. And this is a little bit of a leading question, and I've been on a little bit of a, you know, tirade on this issue in my own writings, but should we be asking the services to think more innovatively about how they operate their forces? Mm-hmm. And some of the ideas that have been out there, I've written about them, but a lot of other people have too. For example, with the Navy under such strain, is it time to be a little less slavishly devoted to a certain deployment schedule? Mm-hmm. Maybe we can occasionally have a gap here and there. You know, for example, in the South China Sea, does it really? It's important that we do freedom of navigation exercises, that China understand we're going to do those. We don't have to do them every week, and we don't do them every mm-hmm. week anyway. So maybe you let the carrier presence, you know, mm-hmm. gap or be delayed between one arrival and the next for a little longer period of time. Or maybe you recognize that these larger amphibious ships we have that can carry 24 aircraft, that can sometimes suffice in a region mm-hmm. that's a little bit less tense, rather than have to send a flat deck carrier. So they can sort of, you know, complement each other rather than be seen as largely separate deployments. Or with the Army, is it time to actually station a brigade in South Korea and one in Poland rather than rotate? Because the rotating consumes the one that was already there, the one that's getting ready. And so all these kinds of ideas. Right. And the last one I'll throw on the table, and then to see if you want to react to any of these or your own thoughts. But, of course, the question's broader. The question is, should the services be innovating more about how they operate the force? Yeah. And so the last one I'll put forth, and I love your thoughts from your Air Force background. I know how hard the Air Force is working in tanker transport support capabilities, and the whole Air Force is working hard. But what I wonder is, could we have some more land-based deployments of fighter squadrons in the Persian Gulf region to take a little pressure off the carrier fleet? Because right mm-hmm. now we do the occasional fighter squadron. We don't base anybody there in terms
we
of
rotate
fighters.
Them. Right.
And so these are the kind of questions mm-hmm. that are on my mind, and I just wondered if you had any reactions.
And if you asked that last question, I don't think I did a good job answering that, so I apologize. So I think innovation is important. I think when you have budget challenges, it forces innovation thinking. And I think we've done some of that. We need to do more of it. So we used to take whole fighter squadrons with their aircraft, deploy them, and then 3-4 months later, you take another fighter squadron, aircraft, everything, you rotate them in. Now we're leaving the aircraft there. So that saves a lot of wear and tear, moving aircraft back and forth. So you pre-position equipment there, and you operate that same equipment. I think like on our remote piloted aircraft, one of the most strained organizations in the Air Force right now, because they've been working 6 days a week. I can't remember the exact 12-hour days, take 2 days off, so 6 and 2. You do that for 5, 6, 7 years, taking away vacation time. That's a tremendous toll. Maybe those hours have changed a little bit, but that's like 6-month-old data there. So now we're bringing in enlisted air crew instead of just having officer air crew. So we're trying to find ways to do it smarter, and I think these challenges make you have to think that way, and that's a good thing. But I think when you start talking about reducing our presence in the South China Sea, reducing our presence, whether it be the Korean Peninsula or our presence in Poland, and I do believe that we should have a permanent presence there. After talking to the Polish leadership this back in May, I know they're in favor of it. But I think what we're really saying is our strategy right now calls for a level of military up here, but we're funding it here. And at some point, we're going to have to adjust our strategy or adjust our funding. And you just can't keep asking the military to operate at this level with this kind of funding. And that's what we're doing right now, I believe. So it gets back to and I think what you're, some of the things you're saying is really more of a strategy question. And do we want to be the defenders in the South China Sea, the turn force with the Philippines and Australians? What is our role with the Korean Peninsula? What is our role in the Baltics? I think we should have a role. I think America withdrawing leads to a more dangerous world. If we're going to do that, we need to fund the military at that level to do it.
And by the way, just to be clear, I'm not suggesting we pull back from Korea or Poland, but I'm wondering if some of the naval...
Presence in the South China Sea, if we do it once a year, is that enough? I don't think it is. I mean, at some point, it's a strategy question.
Right.
And I didn't mean to put words in your mouth.
No, very good. Thank you. Congressman Larson.
And on the last point Don made it, I agree. To answer your question, Michael, you need to start with the strategy. What is it? What is our role? What do we want our role to be? Mm-hmm. What do our friends and our allies want our role to be as well? We need to, I think, continue to recognize there is a demand signal out there for U.S. presence. And defining that presence and how we do that presence is important. I will say this, we're not always going to meet the standard that our friends and allies believe we ought to have in terms of presence, and that should not define what our presence should be either. We're elected to define our presence. Our friends and allies are not elected here in the United States to define our presence. So we have to make that strategic decision, but I think your question is fundamentally a strategic one, and I believe that, and Don noted, the U.S. helped build and lead and has largely led a world order since the end of World War II. It has largely benefited a lot of folks. Certainly benefited the United States, and I'm not ready to give that up or to cede that to another model, because I don't think another model will work as well. So I just think getting to your question is more of a strategic one. The flip side of this is that, in 17 years, and people have been here longer, and they're smarter than me, and people have been here less time in Congress, and they're smarter than me. I will say this, though, that the only thing worse than giving the Pentagon too little money is giving it too much money. It is one of the least disciplined departments that I've run across in 17 years in Congress. And so a little tightening is not a bad thing for the Pentagon. So they make decisions, strategic decisions, to force innovation, to force different ways of thinking about it. I'm not now making the case that today is the situation the Pentagon is in today is the right situation for them. But I just, for them to make decisions about how to change deployments, whether or not to pre-position platforms and move people in and out, they should be doing that, looking at that anyway, and they don't need our help to do it. But if they do need our help to do it, then there's something wrong at the Pentagon, not at Congress.
One of the areas where I think we could save money, at the military tends, if they have a problem, they build a new headquarters or a new staff. Yeah. And I think we have to review the staff levels of bureaucracy, because you have the folks who are doing the warfighting are a smaller number. And I think we got to always review, are we building too many levels of staff up there? And we really need more folks on the ground doing the job.
Yep, thank you. By the way, just a quick plug for Congress, former CBO staff myself. I've always thought Congress's role in defense policy is actually crucial, and that Congress punches above its weight in terms of number of people. And I don't expect the Pentagon to always get it right, because they have cultural biases as well. Yeah. And, of course, they always work for a president, whatever his name, that has his own political agenda. And so everything is within that context. So I think Congress is an indispensable...
Goldwater Nichols is a great example, where I think it was a great change.
I agree that Congress is indispensable.
The indispensable power. So my last question is hopelessly big, and therefore I hope you'll each narrow it down to a specific thing that is not most on your mind. But I wanted to talk at least briefly about overseas threats. You both alluded to them quite a bit already. And you ticked off, Congressman Bacon, a number of the specific places where we are operating or deploy. But I wondered if either of you, or actually if I could ask both of you in turn, to share with us your sort of most pressing concern, not necessarily the threat you think is the most acute, although you can do that if you want, but maybe the threat that we're least correctly understanding, where you'd want to encourage us to think more afresh or more profoundly, more creatively about how to deal with it. So if I could put the overseas threat question in those terms and start with you.
Well, I think we're starting to frame the Russian threat right. I think we had missed that the last 4 or 5 years. I think we now realize their agenda. It's not our agenda. They're not our friend. I wouldn't say they're our enemy, but they're surely our adversary and oppose a lot of our national interests for sure. And I think China, I think we have grounds for some optimism, but also concern that it's a balanced approach there. They surely want to sort of control the countries around them, and I think that would be a mistake for us to withdraw. I think our allies want us there. They want to maintain their independence. But I think we're starting to gauge the threats accurately. The North Korea thing's a hard one to solve, but we know a North Korea with 10 nuclear weapons or 50 nuclear weapons is something we can't, just that the threat is huge, and we can't overlook that. I think maybe if I had to put it on one area, the two things I don't know that we have quite right yet is still Iran, which is not the immediate threat, but I think it's the 10-year, 15-year threat, especially with their support of Hamas, Hezbollah, they are the world's leading terrorist exporter. And so I'm concerned about what that means 10, 15 years from now with Israel and the region there. And I don't know that we have our fight with ISIS or the Islamic extremism quite right. I think we tend to lean too much on the kinetic side or the using force. But how do we stop the recruitment that goes all over from a global recruitment? How do we undermine an ideology that attracts folks from Australia, America, Great Britain, Africa? And how do we undercut that financing? And I think that we've not really done a good job. I think we're talking about it now, but we need a holistic strategy to win this fight. Putting forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, it deals with a symptom. And we have to deal with that symptom because we don't want a terrorist state, say in Afghanistan with Taliban takeover. They're allied with 33 different terrorist organizations. But I think if we only do the kinetic side in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, we're missing the boat. We'll be there forever. So how do we undermine that ideology? How do we undermine the financing? And I've not really heard yet where we got that right. And I think we owe it to really put some smart people together and have a holistic strategy that looks at all those tenets.
Thank you. Excellent.
I don't want to provide a country-to-country global perspective here. So I don't want folks to go away thinking, oh, Larson didn't answer that question. He didn't mention my country, or he didn't mention what I was concerned about. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to focus on one thing that I think that we need to get right better, and that is at times in Congress we lump together Russia and China as a single threat, when in fact what each of those, at least in my view, my subjective assessment is that Russia has a tactical view of the world, and China has a more strategic view. China has an idea of where it wants to be in the world. And it's not necessarily a competitor in every sense with the United States. It's a competitor in some sense. But there is plenty of room for optimism in cooperation in a lot of areas with China. And there's areas of concern. I think Russia's view is one of tactics only, because they don't have the literal firepower, they don't have the economic firepower, they don't have the diplomatic firepower to have a global role. So I think we need to approach our relationships with those two countries differently, and not try to lump them together as if they're in some partnership or cooperative partnership against the U.S. or relative to the U.S. Because I just think that if we do that, we're missing a lot of opportunities to work with a rising China, and we will also miss a clear view of the concerns that we ought to have with a rising China.
Outstanding. Thank you very much. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes to bring you all into the conversation, so if you'd like to ask a question, please get my attention and wait for a microphone, and then identify yourself before posing the question.
We'll start. Ask him all the hard ones.
Yeah, two and two is four. I'm going to answer that one.
Thank you very much. John Schwenk with BAE Systems. Thanks both for speaking with us this morning. You can probably guess what I'm going to ask. Given your leadership roles in the Electronic Warfare Working Group, I wanted to pull the thread on a little bit of something Congressman Larson was talking about and that important capability. It's sort of a capability that's not always publicly recognized, but given some of the things that have happened more recently with things like Russia and Ukraine, that kind of shone a light a little bit on it. So given your two roles in that community, I'm wondering if you could comment a little more publicly about where do you think the services are doing well in EW, where should they be going in the future?
Sure. Yeah, so thanks. So I got involved with being co-chair of the Electronic Warfare Working Group, which has been around Congress since the mid-90s. Members of Congress create these ad hoc groups every once in a while, and this Electronic Warfare Working Group has been focused on EW. And I have a district in Washington State, the fighting second, with Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, and that's where, at the time, I was elected. The Prowler community largely there, and now the Growler community is largely there. These are the Navy's electronic attack aircraft. So I got involved because it was, the platform was in my district, platform from which we deliver electrons to jam radar. And over time, then, that evolved into more of an interest in electronic warfare writ broadly. And so what we did about 7 years ago with the EW Working Group is, I will say, is finally what the Pentagon is doing now. We looked at this problem of EW, which ends up being a feast or famine type of budgeting. If we're in a war, if we're fighting, a lot goes into electronic warfare. And if we operational tempo goes down and we're not fighting as much, then not as much investment goes into electronic warfare. And what we need to do is have a more consistent budget commitment to EW across the services. And that means training, that means developing leaders, that means research with our academic institutions and our federally funded research and development centers. We produced a report, the group did produce a report, we produced a report about 10 years ago with these elements. The Pentagon has now established a couple years ago an executive committee, or XCOM, that is essentially doing just that. Essentially trying to make sure the services are developing leadership, they're developing training, and they're putting research into the next things, as well as budgeting for the next things. And let me give you one example, I'll turn it to Don. And this is not a criticism of the Navy, and it's not a criticism of the contractor or anything, it's just things take too long to get done. And there's something called the next-gen jammer, the next-generation jammer. The next generation jammer in about 2 years will be the last generation jammer, right? I was saying that a couple years ago. It was just taking so long to get to the next generation jammer, and we're now getting there, which is great. But if we use that model future for developing the next generation's jammer, we're going to fall further behind our near competitors like China, as a for instance. We need to fix this commitment to electronic warfare throughout the Pentagon. And that's in part what the working group's about.
I've been very honored to be a part of this working group just started, and it's something that I'm excited about. I'm an electronic warfare officer in the Air Force, and it's a passion of mine, and I enjoy doing that for most of my career. In the 90s, we had the preeminent electronic warfare capabilities in our military. We had a strong doctrine, strong advocacy, good funding. And over time, we walked away from it. And so we let it atrophy. And then the Russians and Chinese, though, saw what we did in 1991, for example, with a very potent electronic warfare. And they invested a lot into electronic warfare. So they've been working hard to beef up their capabilities while we were letting ours atrophy over time. And I think, as I had a chance to have our most recent meeting, with the Electronic Warfare Working Group, I think if you look back like 5 years ago, we were going at maybe a 180 heading, if I can just draw a picture, but we need to be going 000. I think we've made a course correction where maybe we're going 010 or 015. I think we got more work to do, but we're turning the ship back around, going the right direction, in my view. But problem number one, I don't think we have our doctrine right. The electronic magnetic spectrum, in my view, and it's scientifically true, it is a physical domain. And if we don't actually describe it as such, as a physical separate domain, and then you have a strategy, how do you get superiority over that domain? If you don't talk like that, then you're not even on first base. So I think our doctrine right now, though it's been approved, it doesn't get to the truth yet. It's a separate domain, and then you have a separate domain. How do you win in that domain? And there's a reluctance in DOD to call it that because they think that leads to more spending in this area, and they don't want to put more money there. But I just think it's an honest discussion that we need to have that in our doctrine. I think advocacy levels, we used to have two-star generals in the Pentagon that used to oversee electronic warfare. We don't have that today. We do have a one-star STRATCOM that does a joint, and I'm pleased that that's been put in place. But if you look in the joint staff, it's very diffused who's in charge of electronic warfare. I think there should be a single belly button that is an advocate on the joint staff as well. So I think we've made some progress. Here's what we're doing well. We have capabilities out there to make rapid acquisition in some areas, not big weapon systems. But some of the smaller ones, Big Safari and some of these rapid acquisition programs, are able to turn out some new capabilities fast, especially when in a wartime situation. We would encounter new IEDs in Afghanistan and Iraq, and within 1 month, have the counter to them, which was electronic warfare oriented. So that's an area that we're doing pretty well.
Excellent. Thank you. Who else? Yes, sir.
Seamus Daniels, CSIS. Do you think that DOD needs to more clearly define the metrics for readiness? I mean, clearly, we're in the midst of a debate whether we're actually facing readiness challenges, whether we're in a crisis itself. And so I think a lot of that comes from conflating terms such as modernization and operational tempo with readiness itself. And do you think if we redefine it, it'll certainly alleviate the problem of looking at readiness in a political light at times? Thanks.
Want me to tackle? You want to tackle?
You can go first.
I defer to the.
I want to think about that one. Yeah.
I first would say I don't think there is really a debate that we have a readiness problem. It's probably level. How bad is it? But I think it's clear that we have a problem in readiness. So I think I just want to respond to that one comment first. And I think there's some clear metrics. How many aircraft can you fly today? What's the maintenance? What's the readiness rate of or the operational status of your aircraft, your ships? How many people are ready to deploy? Those are tangible, concrete readiness levels, and there's probably 100 of them out there, frankly. So I think that we have, but I think your question is, if I can read into it, what feeds into that loss of readiness? And oftentimes modernization feeds into that loss of readiness. When you have 25-year-old aircraft, which is the average in the Air Force, you're going to have a drop in readiness because they're harder to maintain. You know, our tankers today are 60 years old. You mentioned tankers. KC-135s, 60 years old. B-52s. I think the youngest B-52 was made in 1962, to put it in perspective. We have granddaughters flying B-52s today that their grandfathers flew. To me, it says a big story. So modernization does feed into readiness issues. So I think maybe that's the core of your question. But I would just say there is very objective data and stats that reflect our readiness levels, and I think all of them have been pointing the wrong direction.
Thanks. I think it'd be right to have metrics for what readiness is. At some point, can everything be 100% ready? Well, no. Something will be broken. One thing somewhere will be broken, and you can't deploy it. Therefore, it takes away from 100%. So somewhere between that and where we are now is the right number. But I think you get stuck in the right number. We need the flexibility to not guess what the exact right number is for that. Honestly, what we ultimately have to be driven by is the broader strategy. Where do we want to be in the world? And honestly, in a really big picture debate, which is not really the one we're having here, we are literally having that debate about what is our presence in the world right now. And it is one I think was foisted on us, but it is one we're having nonetheless.
Just one last footnote from me before we'll take our last question and wrap up. CBO, when I was there, one of my colleagues did a study with the sexy name of Selected Indicators of Military Readiness 1980 through 1993. And you can still Google it. It's a great study, and it gets to sort of what you guys are talking about. Yeah. And it's mission capable rates for several dozen categories of equipment, mm-hmm. major equipment. It's funding for readiness and who's been to which major unit exercises or rotations, recognizing you can't track each and every little unit and its daily activity, but you can maybe look at a few bigger exercises. It's the quality and adequacy of the people in the force and at various staffing positions. So it's trying to find that middle ground between just a data dump and something that is, you know, still rich enough and textured enough that you can look for individual problems and try to fix them. To me, that's the right level of data. But I think in this century, we've classified a lot of it, and the services have frankly gotten out of the habit of trying to organize it very well, even for their own purposes. And it leads to a problem that my former Brookings colleague and Columbia professor Richard Betts wrote about. He did a book on readiness 5 years ago. And he had this one chapter, which was entitled Lies, Damned Lies, and Readiness Statistics. Because you can always cherry pick for whatever story you're trying to tell,
right,
if it's not fairly systematically organized and regularly presented. And the last thing, if you do a data trend over time, mm-hmm. then you can compare us to where we were in the 90s, where we were in the 80s, because you're never going to have 100% readiness. So you need some kind of perspective. What's a reasonable standard? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the kind of report that I'd love to see Congress request again a CBO, and then Congress can use its clout to pressure the Pentagon to come together and get this data. And anyway, that's just an advertising thought from a former CBO staff. Please, last question of the day.
Both for coming. My name is Aaron Kiesler. I'm from Lewis Burke. Can both of you talk to us from your roles on the committee, threats that you see coming off on the horizon that you think we should be preparing for today?
No. I can't. Threats. You're looking like 5 to 10 years down the road or yeah. so on. I think the threats are really more how we handle today's threats. I don't know if anything new comes up, but how do you handle, and I don't want to be condescending here, but to folks in China, because we don't, they don't want to be handled. No one wants to be handled. So how do we best manage the U.S.-China relationships, and of which there are many. There is not one. There are many relationships that we have with China, and how do we best manage those to assure allies and friends, as well as to continue to maintain U.S. presence in the region. Because that can be mishandled on China's part and on our part. And if it's mishandled, that could turn into something worse. I'd mentioned North Korea, but frankly, North Korea is today's problem. I can't even think about 10 years from now, right now, on North Korea. I know what I'd want it to look like. I don't want it to be a peninsula, denuclearized, unified, so on. but I, you know, that is today's threat. And so I don't have an answer for you 10 years from now. We're trying to figure out the best way to do it. Take care of that right now.
The threats that I think we should be most nervous about, first of all, space. We're very dependent on space. Space communication, space intelligence. We're going to be into a war-fighting domain over time where we're at space superiority. Our Russians and Chinese are putting a lot of investment into targeting our key space nodes, and we are very dependent on that. And if you take away our space capabilities, which they're trying to do in a big conflict, I think it's going to be a very tough fight. So we're going to have to be thinking ahead 10 years out. How do we defend space? How do we build redundancy? And how do we use deterrence to counter that? So I think that that's an area that it's going to require a lot more attention. And I would say this is old news, but it's not. It's big. It's future news, cyber. The Russians are very good at tactical use of cyber. Right now, they're very aggressive in Ukraine's tactical networks, economic, strategic. They are in their systems owning it. That's what they want to do to us in a current fight. So we have some of the best cyber offensive capabilities, bar none, but we're also the most vulnerable. As I heard a general say, we have the biggest rocks and the biggest glass house when it comes to cyber. And so that's an area that we cannot take for granted, especially with some of the systems we're wanting to field that links all of our tanks, that's an open door for someone like Russia to try to get inside those networks and create mischief. Now, when you look at technologies 20, 30 years out, we need to be thinking about that now, too. Here's an area that we're behind in, hypersonics. China is ahead of us in that area, and that's extraordinarily hard to defend. So we need to be pushing that envelope out there and investing on what our own hypersonic capabilities, but also how to defend against it. I think you're going to see miniaturization of weapons down the road, and what does that mean? How do you use that? Can you imagine what you can do with a drone the size of your hand or even smaller, size of a fly? That's what we're talking 30, 40 years out, so we need to be working that now. So there's a lot of these areas that I think that we have to have our eyes on it now to be prepared for what the future has. So thanks.
It's a great note to finish on. Let me also mention that for those of you who thought that today's big sports event in the Washington area was the Nationals game, there's actually a congressional football game tonight. Democrats and Republicans united against the security staff. I'm not sure where I'm going to put my money.
I know where you should put your money, but...
So in addition to having...
I will say this. I'm not playing. That should give you some hope. Don is playing, so you decide who you want to bet on.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, we've heard a number of names for Congressman Bacon today, some of them actually accurate, some of them invented by me. But in addition to Bacon Bits, in addition to Congressman Don Bacon, he is also apparently wide receiver Don Bacon of the congressional team, and he's survived several practices without pulling a hamstring, which to me is already a victory
for
guys of our team. So please join me in thanking these two
gentlemen.
Thank
you. Appreciate it.